We have talked about it endlessly over the last decade or so, and we've accomplished close to zip.
We know enough about our climate problem to know that it's serious and that we need to get started right away.
What we're seeing right now is a clear loading of the weather dice.
Today, what the warming Arctic means for the food that polar bears, whales, and other animals eat. NPR meteorologist Paul Huttner is here. Paul, we talked a bit about this last week, but remind us about how sharply the temperatures in the Arctic are rising and why we might be seeing this as a consequence.
Yeah, overall, the Arctic is warming twice as fast as the rest of planet Earth as we see our climate change. And this year has been remarkable in the Arctic, especially in the fall when we saw record Arctic sea ice, unusual to unprecedented warmth, with temperatures as much as 36 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than average. So that has produced an area of ice below average the size of Alaska and Texas combined. We actually had melting ice in Arctic darkness in November.
Wow, yeah.
So it's
which
been
has never
very
happened
unusual.
Before.
Not on record, as far as I know, yes.
And the water temperatures? Do you have some data on that?
Well, they've been above freezing.
Okay.
And they get obviously a lot warmer in the summer, and they're warming up earlier in the year. So that, of course, is affecting things like algae and marine life in the Arctic.
Which is what we're going to talk about. Let's bring our guest in. Jackie Grebmeier is a research professor at the Chesapeake Biological Laboratory, and she is with us today from Maryland. Jackie, welcome. It's good to have you here.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here, too.
As Paul noted, we're talking about algae, and I'd like you to give us an idea about how important it is in the food chain and how connected algae is to as we go up and down the food chain.
Right. Algae is extremely important. It's the base of the food chain, so it's like having the wheat that we have on land or something like that. It's what happens in the spring, plant growth. It takes up CO2, gives us oxygen, so it's an important part of our atmosphere and way the survival that we have. So the thing that the Arctic has and the Antarctic is that we have ice algal blooms. So it occurs in the spring under the ice and in the ice channel. So it's the first pulse of carbon as the sunlight comes back out. And then as the ice starts to retreat, we have open water. So you really get the greening in that open. That carbon, that phytoplankton growth is important early season because a lot of it on the shelf I study in the Pacific Arctic settles down to the bottom to feed animals that live in the bottom that are important for diving sea ducks, walruses, gray whales that particularly that come into the system to feed on this very productive area. It's also important that the algae grows through the summertime for zooplankton that start to be cropped then by fisheries, bowhead whales, so forth, that come into the Arctic to feed. So it makes it a very productive system. So anything that you change at that lower level can go very quickly because the food chains are short in the Arctic.
So what do the changes look like?
Well, we're starting to see, because the ice is pulling back earlier, we're getting production earlier in the season. We're getting more open water production because if you have snow on ice, the light doesn't go through it as well. But if the ice starts to retreat, the snow goes away, you can even through ice, you can have light penetrate through it. So you have that algal growth. But if it grows, it's occurring earlier in the season, the animals are adapted to feed at certain times of the year. So what's important on this is that if you change what we call the phenology, basically the timing of when these organisms are growing and when the prey or the predators are consuming them, you can have a big effect on life cycles of those animals. For example, we're seeing declines in some of the food that are important for these threatened sea ducks, for example, where we've been studying 30 years. The carbon is not as much going down to the bottom, a lot of it, because we have a change of production. And then the result is that water is warming, so animals actually are moving further north. So what we see is, in fact, that this changing in timing of sea ice retreat, on one side, it's opening up areas for more primary production, but on the other side of it, it changes the timing, which can have a disruption on food webs.
Jackie, Paul Huttner here. Good to speak with you this morning.
Yep.
The Arctic obviously cannot be an easy place to get to do research. You know, what's the current state of the science in the Arctic and how complete really is our knowledge of the Arctic marine ecosystem?
That's a very good question. I mean, we have three icebreakers in the United States, two that were built in the 1970s and one that was in the 90s. And so compared to Russia, like, that has 15.
Wow.
And so we have new ones being built in the Asian countries and in Canada. So we're always, you know, the importance of having icebreakers, it not only has the influence of going to do science, obviously, but it's a forward for watching the borders that we have in our country. But what it is because the sea ice is retreating like it is, we're able to access the area that we didn't used to, even in ships that aren't ice strengthened. So as far as the timing, I've been up on cruises in March using a heavy icebreaker. And then running till October. But after that, when the ice comes back and it gets dark, we primarily only have pieces of equipment that are measuring. We don't go out there from October until probably the previous March. So half of the year, we really have very limited coverage of what's going on in the Arctic system.
Jackie, a couple times Paul and I have talked to scientists who are studying how marine life are adapting even this soon to changes with the climate and to access to food and all that. I wonder if there's any kind of data around that yet with what we're talking about in the Arctic.
I think, for example, we know that polar bears can breed on land with brown bears. So you sometimes, because they originally were on land and then went out to sea and then became evolved into polar bears. So there's a capability for that. For walruses that depend on sea ice and are basically marine, that's a potential of a decline for that. A lot of these animals depend on really high production. They have their young down south. For example, gray whales in the warm waters of Baja will go down and have birth their young there. Then they'll go up 3,000 to 4,000 kilometers to feed on what is a really highly productive system. So this migration is built into their genetics. One of the things you're asking is if the changes, if you change organism, you may change an organism at the prey base. If it's the same type or gives the same calorie, then maybe have an invasion or a change of one species to another won't have that dramatic of an impact. But if you change the physiology or the functioning of that group, you can have a major change on that.
Jackie, how about the human factor? Can the opening of the Arctic in terms of less ice increase productivity potentially? Are we going to see new fisheries and food supplies for humans there? Is the Arctic going to become the new sort of deadliest catch?
That's a good question. There's two. Depends on where you are, and it's just like when you talk about in the article I think from the New York Times or in the Science article. Depends spatially where you're at. For example, in the U.S. side of the Pacific, where we have our largest fisheries in the southern Bering Sea, the system is cold over the wintertime, so a lot of the commercial fish don't go into the Arctic right now. And those that are there are small and not at commercial levels, although we do see some commercial-level crabs up on the slopes because we're getting warming water along the Alaska coastal side. But it's not the large fisheries that right now. By comparison, in the Barents Sea, where they have their large fishery, they are seeing fisheries moving northward. So there's a real interest around the Pan-Arctic of the potential. We don't know the timing yet. We do know on the Atlantic side that they're doing more and more studies further north because the fish are going there. On the Pacific side, there is not that large fisheries, but the fisheries and the resource utilization folks are looking at that potential. I would say one of the things that's coming forward in the community is the Central Arctic Ocean. Once everybody keeps their 200-mile limit into the Arctic Ocean, the five Arctic countries, there's a small area in the central area that is basically international waters. And nobody really knows what the fisheries are like there. They're probably small right now, but there's for potential for exploration. So there is a very large interest of tracking. No, doing the research first before you start to exploit and maybe take out a fish species, as was done with the donut hole in the Bering Sea.
Jackie, we have a call for you. Are you game for that?
Sure.
Okay, good. To Brian in Chaska. Hi, Brian. Your question.
Hi. I'm a geologist locally, mm-hmm. and I've had this question. No one's answered this. And you're just talking about melting ice. We have these ice cores from Greenland and Antarctica. And they have a record of the temperature changes. And the temperature is been changing a lot, and it fluctuates like a ticking clock. It's very regular, and this goes back 800,000 years, some of these records from the South Pole. And I'm wondering, it's the concept of an unconformity as a geologist. We're just mentioning that ice melts when it's warm, and I'm wondering, they always say we've never had temperatures this high, and when we compare back to ice core data, if there's no ice being accumulated because it's too warm, how do we look at those ice core data? There's nothing to analyze when the ice is not deposited. How do they know how warm it's been in the past if there's no ice being deposited during
Brian,
warm periods?
I think we've got it. I want to give Jackie a chance to answer that. Jackie, go ahead.
Right. It's not my. It's not. I'm not an ice core, but I knew a specialist on that. I do geology down core, where we look at dating on that. But with those ice cores, they're actually looking at the bubbles of CO2 in those cores, and being able to do a calibration on the temperature associated with some of those gas components in those cores. Now, those cores, remember, aren't sea ice. So when we talk about sea ice that's coming and going, and when we talk about seasonal sea ice in the Arctic or even in the Antarctic, and then there's what's called multi-year ice. But that's sea ice, and that's not what's causing global sea level rise. It's those large ice sheets that are in the Antarctic and in Greenland where you have those long records. So we can, we'll still, you know, so that's people need to know the difference between when we say sea level, melting sea ice, that's not going to change sea level rise. It's the melting of those big glaciers. But it's the signatures in those very deep cores that are allowing us to look back at 800,000 years using the chemistry in them to back out temperature change.
That was a great answer. Paul, do you want to add anything to that?
Sure. And the reason we keep getting data year to year is that even in the warm periods throughout the climatological past, we still have winter in Antarctica and in places like Greenland. So you still accumulate snow during that season, which then turns into an ice layer as time compresses. So there's still snow in the winter happening to produce ice that they can eventually drill cores from.
So when Brian says no one has been able to answer this, this is the answer. Brian, Jackie, thank you very much. I hope you'll come back and talk to us on the ClimateCast again. This is very interesting.
I would be happy to.
Thanks,
thank
Jackie.
You very much.
And Paul, tell me what you're watching this week.
Well, I'll tell you what, the war on science heated up once again with sort of a semi-fake news post by Breitbart versus the Weather Channel. The Weather Channel
took offense.
Okay, you have
to explain this because it's complicated. Tell us what happened with this.
It is. Breitbart basically published a piece that says that temperatures over land areas of the Earth have been dropping in the last year by as much as a degree Celsius. Now, that's like saying that land is only 30% of the Earth. So they cherry-picked one small percentage, which isn't even the whole data set. That's like water is 70%. So that's almost like taking the three worst batters on the New York Yankees out of the nine who are in the lineup and saying that the Yankees are hitting more poorly. They're not hitting as well.
Okay.
Global temperatures that we use include the whole planet, not just the land areas. Data is normalized for El Nino, still shows the two warmest years on record the last 2 years. And climate scientists, as we've talked about, have always expected a slight drop in temperatures next year once the El Nino has faded. Yet we're still have not seen a cooler than average year globally since 1976. So there's always these little fluctuations. Not only did they take a little fluctuation, they took only a part of that data, 30% of it, and tried to make the case that global climate change is a hoax. So the Weather Channel called them out on this week, and it was very interesting to hear that as we try to keep scientific fact in the forefront, even though some people are trying to cherry pick and essentially tread that line for fake science news.
Paul, I was talking to some students yesterday at Concordia, and we were talking about news sourcing, and I was saying, and I know you concur with this, you have to be a skeptical news consumer wherever, and you have to bring in information from a lot of different places.
Right.
So if you're only getting your climate news from Breitbart, you're not getting, obviously, the whole or the true picture.
Not at all. And, you know, we live in an era where everybody's Facebook, quote, news feed is different, right? Depending on what Facebook algorithms detect your politics is.
Right.
So it seems like there isn't just one news anymore now. And you really do have to buy or beware on news these days.
That's the ClimateCast, and I thank you very much, Paul.